Tour is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. I'm your host, Brian Ray. On this show, we'll take you behind the scenes of the music business to give you the most raw and real tales you've likely never heard before. We'll share our wildest, most unbelievable, and yes, most embarrassing moments while on tour. It was such a joy sitting down with my longtime friend Davy Johnstone in his beautiful home. Starting as a teenager in the pubs of Edinburgh, Scotland, it seemed British folk was Davy's path. Thankfully for us, he made the transition to rock and roll. For 50 years, he's brought unforgettable music and moments to stages across the world with Alice Cooper, Meatloaf, Stevie Nicks, Bob Seger, and most notably with Sir Elton John. In this conversation, he takes us inside his first meeting with a very young, shy Elton John, the rise of a superstar, and their genuine friendship, along with surreal moments backstage and on stage with John Lennon. Here's my conversation with Davy Johnstone. Davy, welcome to my show. It's such an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
I'm thinking about it. You probably have one of the longest running sideman gigs in the industry. You've been with Elton for nearly 50 years. You've played well over 2,000 shows together. And you've been the one constant member of his band throughout that entire career. My God.
Scary.
Yeah, indeed. And I think to myself, you must have built such a strong bond to have been with him all these years. And I was just wondering if you can recall any one challenging moment in the early days which bonded you guys that may have explained why you're together for all of these years.
It could be, actually. I'm thinking of the very first time I met him, which is at Trident Studios in 1971. He was doing Madman Across the Water album, and I was asked by Gus Sudgeon, his producer, and my dear friend at that time, would you like to come in and play on this guy's records? His name's Reg. He's a singer-songwriter, and he's doing some really good stuff. And I didn't know who Reg was. So I show up at Trident with my acoustic guitar, mandolin, and sitar. This little guy sitting behind the piano, very nervous, very quiet, and obviously quite shy. So, you know, I just said, hi, you know, I went over, shook his hand. I said, do you want to play me one of the songs you want to do? And he played Tiny Dancer.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, nice song. Okay, that's good. And then he played Leave On. And I'm going, okay, this is a fun session. I'm really enjoying this already. I haven't played a note.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he played a song called Holiday Inn, which was also from Madman Across the Water. And it was one of the tracks that I was booked to play banjo on. And he played the song. And the first thing I said to him was, well, I think actually mandolin's going to be better than banjo on this. It's a bit lighter, a bit airier, a bit more atmospheric. And I think it'll work better. And he was like, okay. So he immediately, I think, felt good because somebody was having rapport with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he tends to be quite shy and he doesn't really automatically open up to people, you know, even today, you know, 50 years later. And I remember when we were just about to cut the track and there was myself, Barry Morgan on drums, Herbie Flowers on bass, Ray Cooper on percussion, who's still around with us.
Sure, sure.
And Paul Buckmaster was arranging and watching the whole thing as far as what he was going to do with the strings. And we had a problem how we were going to start the song. Well, you know, Elton didn't have an intro for it. And Gus was saying, well, how are you going to start this? You know, and I said, well, why don't we just start it? Don't have any intro. Just come straight in with the vocal and the music straight in. And he tried it and he said, oh, great. So automatically he felt comfortable with me. And that kind of vibe has stayed to this day where he trusts me as what I would suggest to him musically.
Yeah.
Which is probably why I'm musical director.
Right.
And I adore his music and he knows that.
Right.
So I think that was the moment that kind of solidified, okay, we're buddies and we're musical buddies and this is going to hang on.
That's great. Establishing a trust early on.
Right.
And having some input.
That yes.
Obviously wasn't threatening or difficult
right.
for him. He was actually asking and
yeah.
you had a couple of suggestions right off the bat.
That's yeah, and there was another track on that record, the title track, Madman Across the Water,
yeah.
that I was actually brought in to play because they tried it with a few other guitar players and they hadn't been able to get the sound that, or the just the vibe they wanted on this riff that Elton had. So he played me the riff on piano and I said, well, something like this. And I played what I thought. And he said, that's what I want. So right there, we had two things that happened in the space of the first hour of me meeting this guy that were really just kind of locked us in as musical friends. I saw straight away, okay, this guy's massive talent. And then somebody told me, oh yeah, Elton John, this guy is going to be huge. And I'm going to, really? Because I was a total folky. I did not really have any clue about who was doing what in the rock scene per se. So it was really lovely doing that session amongst all this other stuff that I'd been doing, you know.
Yeah, so he must have seen in you the dream guitar role, the guy. Because, you know, some of those big songs, Saturday Night's All Right for a Fight and Mad Men, are so guitar driven. They start with very important copyrights of guitar licks that you're responsible for, you know.
Yeah.
So from the very beginning, you saw Elton on TV. I imagine you loved his music and saw what we all saw in him. And a year later, you were off touring with him. How old were you then?
I did this my first session with that I was just talking about on Mad Men record when I was 20. And then I got the call the next day saying he wants you to join his touring band of Nigel Lawson, Dee Murray, and you, and that's going to be it, the four-piece. And I went, great. But, you know, the whole first year with him was completely mental. On more than one occasion, I called him up and said, you know, I don't know if this is for me. I don't know if I can do this.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I was. In fact, the first time we played the Forum, there was like Dylan and Joni Mitchell and, you know, who I idolized.
Yes.
And Danny Hutton and, you know, Nilsson, people that were just like, shit, you know, these are my idols. And they were our first gig. And I was just not ready for that, having never been to LA before either. And it was just a whole thing. So I called him up one time after the Forum show, which I think was around about, it was around about May or June of 1972. And I said, look, I don't think I can do this. And he completely talked me down. He said, don't be stupid. This is what we do. And this is what it's going to be. And I said, but all these big name people, don't you want to have more of a rock and roll kind of guy? And he said, no, I want you. And that's what I want. So suddenly I went from being this folky who loved rock and roll. I mean, my idols were the Beatles, obviously.
Yeah,
that was what I listened to growing up. I mean, and then later Led Zeppelin. I loved Jimmy Page because that whole acoustic electric thing.
Yeah.
That he had obviously mastered both sides of it.
I found that to be a really interesting aspect of early Zeppelin too, with the acoustic stuff, going to California and all that stuff. Just amazing work. Were you a fan of like Fairport Convention and Pentangle and bands like this?
Huge.
Were you?
That was another thing that Elton and I were able to converse about, was our love of British folk rock.
Yes.
And it was a really cool thing.
Yeah, I get a picture of you being a multi-instrumentalist when you were young in the folk scene, the British folk scene, which was quite big. And so that is, there's a lot more humility and sort of a humble nature to those performances and those records that is not about showbiz at all.
Right.
And here you are suddenly finding yourself on a, literally on a rocket, and playing at the Forum with Rocket Man.
It's like
amazing sort of juxtaposition of what you first saw yourself as. Was there a band that, just to jump back and foreshadow all this, what was the band that you were playing in when I read somewhere that Gus discovered you at some gig or something like that?
Oh, the band that I was in was called Magna Carta.
Okay.
And they were like the folk rock type of thing. Mm-hmm. That was very, very fashionable, very happening at that point. So Magna Carta got me into play on one of their albums, and they were just the best guys. And,
yeah.
So I showed up, and there's all these like heavy cats, you know, on this date who I'd read, you know, like Chris Spedding and people. I'm going, Jesus, what am I doing here? You know, I consider myself very fortunate to be around at that time.
Mm. I had a lot of exposure to the folk rock days. My sister and her husband were a folk rock duo called Jim and Jean. So they were in the Village playing alongside of, you know, all the biggies, you know? And it was just a different headspace. It's like the folk generation really came out of the beat generation and out of thinkers and people like, you know, everyone we've come to know and love from the early folk scene. And it was a very different scenario and a different lifestyle than you would find in the rock scene that came later. But Elton's interesting because it is sort of like the melding of those times. You know, he was definitely influenced by some of that. And I'm sure that what you brought in was more facilitating the folk vibe into his music, kind of infusing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the band's obviously gone through a lot of different changes over the years. And
Dee,
we lost in 92, which was just so tragic. Way too young to lose such a talent as that. amazing bass
player. I remember, yeah, amazing bass player, man. Yeah. Those bass lines are just iconic.
And Nigel, his birthright was to be Elton's drummer.
Yeah.
Is that sound, the Nigel Olsen thing? It's what it is.
It sure is, yeah.
And nobody else can play that. There's so many amazing drummers in the world and great drummers have been in this band, but nobody can play those fills like Nigel.
Yeah, they're hooks.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that your guitar intros and solos are hooks, those big drum fills. And these bass parts are very much part of the hooks. You can't really lay those songs out there without including those hooks. And I'm sure you guys still include those hooks to this day.
Yeah.
People like to hear their memories, you
absolutely.
Know, brought you back know, to them. Yeah.
And then obviously to get a nod from John, for example, John Lennon would call us up.
Yeah.
In the middle of doing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, we got a call and it was early 1973 and Elton came back from the telephone looking white and shell-shocked. And it was like, what's happened? He said, that was John Lennon, you know, and he really likes what we're doing. So when you get that kind of validation, that becomes something that's like, wow, okay, well, we must be on the right track, I guess. And then in the 70s, we decided instead of flying over to America, we'd take the SS France. And it's like a five-day voyage from Southampton to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So Elton and myself, and I think Nigel came on it. I'm not sure if Ray, Ray did come, but he never came out of his cabin. I think he was seasick, he found out, and that was it. But on that trip, we actually helped Cynthia Lennon bring Julian out because Julian was coming out to meet his dad. We became great friends with Julian. He was only like maybe 11 or 12 at the time. So yeah, after the voyage ended, the ship pulled into New York Harbor. Lo and behold, John is there to meet us and to meet his son. And so we all say hi. And he says, okay, I'm going to come out and meet you guys at Caribou Ranch where you're recording. Great. John came out for like a week and played on Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, sang on it as well. And I never forget, because I was like going, God, this is John Lennon, and he's going to play one of my guitars, you know. And I gave him my Gold Top, I think a guitar from like a 1960s Gold Top, a really nice guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, will you tune it for me? Because you're the guitar player, you know. And I was like, oh, God, you know. I said, you're John Lennon. He's going, well, tune me guitar, will you? So I tuned the guitar up. Now, little did I know, that little thing about tune my guitar was going to come up 6 months later. I'll get to that story, which is a good one. So, you know, he did Lucy in the Sky, a song called One Day at a Time, I think it was called. And there was a couple of songs that he played on, and it was just so cool to do that with John. And he had fun just hanging out in the studio with us, and we got to know him, and it was just a comical time. Lots of great fun, and we were all hooked on oxygen, believe it or not. There was other things that were, you know.
A mile high. And high as well.
Yeah.
Up behind Boulder, right? Is it that studio way up there?
That's right.
Yeah.
There's Boulder, and then there's Nederland is the last town, and then there's Caribou Ranch.
Right, Caribou.
So we were having a blast up there. During that tour, Elton had played on one of John's singles, and I was at the session. It was called Whatever Gets You Through the Night.
Sure.
And there was an engineer on the session. That was it, one engineer. Jimmy Iovine was the engineer.
I see.
Whenever I see him nowadays, I tease him about it. So on that session, Elton played some piano and sang harmony to John. And when he was playing the piano track, John was like going, oh, this is perfect. And he's going, oh, that's it. He's got it in one take. And I said, let him do one more. It'll be even better. Trust me, you know. He said, okay. So he did one more take and it was awesome. I mean, it was like through the roof. Just Elton's piano. It's rock and roll piano.
He's really going for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it
we
just
all
like,
love
and
that.
It was only the second tape and it was perfect. So Elton said, okay, I've done that for you. If it gets to number one, you've got to come on stage with us. And John was like, well, I'll do that happily because he never thought it was going to be a single. He never thought it was going to be number one. It was.
Sure it was.
It hit number one in like October that year.
Huge record.
Yeah. So Elton said, okay, you live up to your promise. So we knew we were playing Madison Square Garden on Thanksgiving, 74. So the idea was to get John up on stage with us. So he said, okay, Now, he was very nervous because he hadn't played on stage for maybe 6 or 7 years.
Sure.
And nothing big since the Beatles. So he was terrified. So we're backstage at the Garden, and John comes into the dressing room looking green. I mean, he was like green. And I looked up and it was like, are you okay? He said, no, I think I'm going to throw up. And I said, oh, you'll be fine. He said, so how long before we go on? I said, about 15 minutes. So again, I'm tuning his guitar. And he's saying, 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes. And he says, we used to get a bit of Fanny round about now. And I was tuning up the guitar and I said, what? He said, we used to get a bit of Fanny round about now. And I'm going, I thought you said that. He said, yeah, but 15 minutes before we were going to go on stage, they'd bring girls in, you know. And I went, the Beatles rock. I gave him a big hug and I said, rock and roll. It doesn't get any better than that. That's hilarious.
I love that. And, great story.
Yeah. And he came out on stage and it was awesome. We did like, I don't know, I think we did 4 or 5 songs. And when Elton announced him, it was right in the middle of our set. I've never heard a roar like that in my life. It was ridiculous. And it was wonderful for John when he came on, because automatically to get that kind of reception.
Well, surely you were expecting that kind of reception. What was the first of the, you said 4 songs you did. What
was the first one? So I was standing there.
So did that put him at ease a little bit? Just a little rocker that he could get into?
It really did. And he said something like, here's a song by an old fiance of mine, meaning Paul, obviously.
You know?
And it was so sweet, him saying that. And it was just great.
So sweet. Oh, I didn't know that story. That's so great.
It was so nice. Yeah.
Oh my God. So was there a point there where you got emotional just from that moment there?
I mean, totally.
Do you have to hold back tears? Because that's a big deal.
Oh, you're suddenly going like, you know, well, number one, I'm in Madison Square Garden. It's insane what's happening. And John Lennon's on stage standing next to you singing Beatles songs. And, you know, we're all getting chills and it was completely nuts. In fact, I remember being on stage when all this is happening and I could feel, because you've played the Garden, you know
sure.
what it's like.
Yeah.
The stage starts to move
mm-hmm.
when people are getting louder and they're moving and stomping their feet.
Yeah.
The stage moves.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought it was going to collapse because it was moving so much.
Yeah.
So it was insane. And, we were all on such a high for the rest of the gig. And then after the gig, there was a wonderful party that we had where Uri Geller, remember him?
Came sure, along. Yeah.
He was bending people's room keys and
shit. Spoons, yeah.
He was bending spoons and room keys. And
yeah.
Everybody was getting locked out of their room. And I remember later on, I was back at the Plaza in my suite that I shared with Dee Murray. We were in there and we're just going, what was all that? That was insane. And the phone rings and it's Elton. And he says, what a gig, right? What an amazing gig. And I'm going, yeah, it's insane. He said, listen, John's here and he wants to come over and hang out with you guys. Is that okay? And I said, nah, tell him to fuck off. And I said, of course, don't be so stupid, of course. Turn him over,
yeah.
You know? Like many other recollections of John or any of the Beatles, you think, you know, it's because I'm sure it was the same for you growing up. I mean, those guys were 10 years older than me at the
yeah.
time of my growing up, and that was who I listened to and first started playing guitar to and learning their parts
right.
and stuff. And now I'm going like, I'm one of these guys.
Exactly.
It was insane.
Yeah, well, I was 8 years old when I first heard the Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand and Please Please Me, and in such quick succession, all of those records.
Right.
And then just after I turned 9, Ed Sullivan. And I wouldn't for a minute admit to my friends that one day I'm going to do something like this, because they'd like punch you.
Of course.
Like, get the hell out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess some part of me hoped that would happen. I was always already so enamored with rock and roll.
The whole thing.
As the whole thing. I just, after I saw the Beatles, I literally didn't have a plan B. That's what I wanted to do.
Exactly.
But that
and
must have been.
Things, you can't explain that to somebody, right?
You can't admit it.
Somebody at that age, like
yeah.
you say, you'll either get beaten up or they'll say, as they said to me many times,
yeah.
don't be so stupid. You know,
yeah.
you know, get a job, get a trade, learn a trade and get a real job. And,
yeah.
you know, and it was like, well, say what you want. That's what I'm going to do.
Hey, when you're a kid, you don't want to stand out or stick out or have a big dream because they will beat you down.
Sure.
I hate to say it, it's just true.
Yeah.
So you had to hold a dream like this a little close to your vest, but even you couldn't believe that it was happening to you.
Yeah, but you know, I think because I was so determined from a very young age, because when I turned like 14, 15, I was already playing folk gigs on the weekend when I wasn't at school. One of my big heroes was Barney McKenna, who played with a band called the Dubliners.
Sure.
The Dubliners were just a really great Irish folk band.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just hilarious. They were great musicians and great singers, but they were very funny. And they drank copious amounts of Guinness.
Can't imagine.
So I loved them for their Guinness consumption because that's why I love draft Guinness and other things. I would show up knowing they'd be in a certain pub in Edinburgh after one of their shows, because that was the thing. In folk music especially, that's where bands met up, the local pub, you know?
Yeah.
And they'd hang out and they might even start playing.
Sure.
So I would show up there knowing that this might happen, bring my banjo, and be in a pub totally illegally, drinking Guinness, really underage. And then I'd say, well, I want to play with the banjo player because he'd be having a session and he'd be playing.
After a pint or two, you were ready to go.
And I was ready. Well, I mean, I knew that's what I wanted to do, but I'd have to work my way to the front of all these big, sweaty Irishmen and Scotsmen and go, okay, I want to play with this guy.
Mm.
And they'd go, you know, piss off, you know, you're way too young. Look, let me play with him. The first time I did that, and I'd be again 15, not quite 16.
Yeah.
And I played and I held my own with this guy on a couple of really crazy fast Irish reels.
Yeah.
One of them called The Mason's Apron, which is a very famous Irish piece that my friend Barney McKenna, at that time my absolute idol, and I held my own with him. So we became friends. They realized that, all right, he can do this. So we'll let him hang on. Mm-hmm. We'll let him hang out with us, you know? So I was hanging out with people twice my age at a very young age.
Yeah, I was as well. And it's back to that thing where, you know, for me, folk music as influenced by Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and all the greats that came before them was very much sort of political, and it was very of the head and the heart. And then here comes rock and roll that's from the heart and the balls.
Oh, you know, it's like,
suddenly here's this lower chakra thing that's all about sex, you know. And Elton was right in that point where those two were sort of one influence in a way.
Right.
And a lot of what you brought to that was your own influence of being a part of the folk scene.
Oh, thanks, Brian.
Well, yeah, man.
You know, I really touched on something there about rock and roll and about sex and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, the imagery and all the rest of it. One of the cool things was that we had a secret weapon that we weren't really aware of. Elton obviously was aware of it, and that was Bernie Taupin.
Sure.
When you have somebody writing lyrics like that, and suddenly this guy will bring a lyric that is already done.
Yeah.
So you're not writing songs after you've made a riff that's really cool.
Right.
And you're trying to write a song around it. This guy brings you a lyric. Oh, this one's called Rocket Man. Okay. Well, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
So you've already got the finished lyric.
Sure.
It became something that was like, oh, this is awesome, because not all the songs were necessarily about sex.
Yeah.
You know, you still had enough songs that were about sex, but there were also other songs that were about, you know, dodgy love affairs.
Yeah.
You know, there was a song called All the Young Girls Love Alice that's very current today with that whole gender thing that's going on.
Sure.
You know, so Bernie was just the most amazing, amazing part of our band, to have somebody bring in the lyrics.
Yeah, that's really true. His lyrics are so evocative and such great story, and they pull you in so well. Do you remember your very first concert with Elton and the feelings that came with that, the looks on the faces of the people out in the crowd?
Yes, I do. It was pretty scary because of two aspects, because there was going to be two halves for the show. One half was going to be Royal Festival Orchestra at the Royal Festival Hall. But we were going to open the whole show. The first half was going to be the new band debuting the next album, which was Honky Chateau.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe the album had just come out. So the only thing that anybody knew from that album was Rocket Man, which had instantly become a smash. So thank God we had at least that, you know. So I was terrified. When it got to actually walking out on stage, I suddenly thought, this is weird, because I can see all these rockers in the audience and different people who were showing up to obviously to check us out, what it was going to be like.
On your very first gig.
Very first gig.
Very off-putting.
And, you know, and it's not just going out there and just doing a set of, you know, balls to the wall rocker. We're doing this album, you know,
yeah,
which they don't really know either.
A little risky, yeah.
They know Rocket Man, and thankfully there was a few rockers on that record, so we were able to get them at it. But it went fine. It went really good. But there was another thing coming up, because the second half of the concert was going to be the orchestra with Elton, but I was the only band member playing in the orchestra. Because you see, in those days, Dee and Nigel were never part of the recording. They were his tour band, but they never played on the records.
Mm-hmm.
So I just met them for the album. We'd never done a show together. And I'm thinking, oh God, help. We never really had a rehearsal for it.
Really?
No.
Remarkable.
And to be totally, brutally honest, they didn't like me. So I'm going, shit, how do I deal with this? And I remember after the gig, which went down brilliantly, it was great because the orchestra conducted by Paul Buckmaster,
mm-hmm,
who's also passed away a year ago, mm-hmm, who I adored Paul, we were great friends and a brilliant musician.
Remarkable.
And this concert was brilliant. It was amazing. And the audience are loving it. And okay, we have a hit. We know what it is. Elton's relaxed. He came up to me. Brilliant job. Thank you so much. And I said to him, this is the first time I said it. I said, Elton, I don't know about this. These guys hate me. It's not going to work. He's going, oh, fuck them. It's going to work great. I say what is going to work and it's going to work, you know? So it was like, okay, whatever you say. And so it was very difficult, that whole first 3 or 4 months.
So interesting. Was there ever a time in your early touring where you were really stuffed into a van, or what were your earliest tours like together? Were you immediately in the fourth dimension?
I know I was well, because that's the way it was.
Yeah.
But you've got to remember as well, those early tours were still Holiday Inns,
yeah,
stuff like that.
Sure.
So there was no private planes or no, the most private we got was renting a Greyhound bus and sitting in that, you know, through Texas for 6 hours or something. So it was all Holiday Inns and Greyhound buses and that kind of shit. So very much that. But Dee and Nigel never really let me forget through those early tours that they were the main guys and I was really an intruder, you know. So I remember getting to Amsterdam once. Now, I felt a bit better about this because we're kind of suddenly on my turf. I'd played in Europe with Magna Carta and different people. So I knew Amsterdam really well because that's where all the hippies went.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically a folky hippie kind of guy. We played in Amsterdam, and after the show, we're back in the room and they're starting to accept me a little bit more, but they're still, you know, this thing of you're the new guy. And they said, okay, we need some food, but room service is closed. You have to go out and get us some food. So I go, okay, these guys are a couple of assholes, but I'll do it and I'll show them. So I went out like, this is be about 11:30 at night, almost midnight. We've done a show and we're in Amsterdam and I take off and I know where I'm going. I'm heading to this place that I know has got best Thai satay. So I go and I get like 4 tubs of chickens and beef satay with all the peanut butter sauce and all the good stuff. Because see, that's where we used to eat. All the folkies and hippies would find these great places because they were so stoned after hours, they'd have to find good food cheaply, you know?
Yeah.
So I knew this place and brought back this food and they had to accept straight on, okay, he's one of the guys because he knows how to do this shit as well, you know? So I was brought into the fold, as it were, at that point.
That's a great story. I remember early bonding with Etta James, with whom I got my start, and she loved barbecue. So early days, I mean, talking 1974,
right,
she would have these barbecues out of the house where she would clean the kitchen sink and put all the sauce and all of the meats in this thing. And I remember saying to me an hour into it, Brian, you could go. You know, you can really go. You know, I'm just a little skinny white kid from Glendale, but I think that was a bonding thing, much like you and Dee and Nigel. It's so funny.
That's
food is a bonding thing, always has been.
Well, it is. Any food or any kind of thing like that, you know, that is more of like the, okay, this is who we are and we're all on the same level.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about inspiration. It's often said that it takes about 10,000 hours of dedication and preparation to achieve the kind of success that, you know, you were able to achieve. Is there any advice that you can offer to musicians that are just starting out now who would love to be in your position?
Well, I mean, I can only tell people what I did. And that was, I did my 10,000 hours for sure. And I know, for example, that Paul and the Beatles did their 10,000 in Hamburg and all the places that they worked. There's no substitute for sitting in your room and learning to play properly by listening. Well, nowadays nobody listens to records, but that's what I did. I took my one or two Beatles records that I had and learned to play every single track on that album. I took my one or two Shadows records and did the same thing. I took a couple of my sister's Elvis records and did the same thing. Took them in and learned everything that Scotty Moore did. And, you know, so I knew everything that the Stones and the Beatles and the Kinks and all those bands that had records in the charts.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I learned what they did. And subsequently, when I decided to go back in time a little bit, or not back in time, but get into guitar more deeply, I learned to play everything that people like John Renbourn and Bert Jansch and John Martin and Jimmy Page later on playing acoustic guitar, you know, learn to play properly. There is no substitute for having the whole thing down. If you learn to play all these instruments well, you know, you've got something behind you before you walk into a room and say, yeah, I can do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no amount of bullshit ever gets, you know, they can never substitute for having the knowledge before you walk in there.
Yeah, and it helps to sing a bit, as you do. That's a big,
huge
consideration when you're looking for a gig, and they can hire someone who plays really well and then another guy who plays really well and sings well. So that's a big plus as well.
You're right, Brian. And the other one, and that's a very good point. The other thing is not being such a great lead singer. Be a great background singer, but don't be too good.
Don't challenge the lead singer.
Do it a little bit so they know you can come, you can bring it, but don't ever challenge the lead singer.
Don't do that, right?
Holy shit.
And so who are you listening to now? Is there any great music that you're listening to that, you know, is more current?
Well, I get subjected to great music. Always have done by listening to my kids' music. Mm-hmm. I always, you know, I have many children and they've always turned me on to great music. My 14-year-old right now, Elliot, has turned me on to Billie Eilish, who I love.
Very good.
And it's just great.
She's great, yeah.
And it's just so different and so original. Mm-hmm. That's what I think I like most about it. Mm-hmm. So that's for my 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. For my 21-year-old, who's my next eldest, he turned me on to like Lamar, and a lot of the hip hop guys I normally maybe wouldn't have listened to.
Right.
But the fact that there was a lot of jazz influence going on there, then I listened to that. My 24-year-old daughter, John Mayer, although I turned the tables on her 16th birthday in New York City when John came along to our gig. My daughter Juliet was having her 16th birthday, that celebration that night. And I brought her into a room where John Mayer was, and she had no clue she was going to meet John Mayer.
Oh my God.
She burst into tears and started crying. But I've turned her on to the Beatles and the Stones and Hendrix, and she in turn turned me on to John Mayer in more ways than, you know, I love John's music. He's a great guitar player.
Good writer.
Great songwriter.
And, good singer.
You know,
Yeah.
So, you know, all that stuff, I tend to go for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because of my generation, where I come from, I don't try and hang with people from this generation. Like, if I would never walk into a room where Billie Eilish was, for example, and say, oh, hi, Billie, I love your shit.
Yeah.
Because she'd probably start laughing or throw up or one of them, or both. I don't know. But, you know, it's, I've always listened, tried to listen to current stuff just because I want to hear what's going on. I don't always love it, but some of it's great. I adore people like Eddie Vedder because he's become a close friend as well. And I love bands like Metallica because Kirk Hammett's become a friend of mine. And I listen to his music because he's become a good buddy. But
it's a great variety from Billie Eilish to Metallica there.
Yeah, but I don't think you can necessarily say, well, I like that, but I don't really like that. I think if you like one thing, because I mean, I think the Beatles really taught me that, to appreciate all kinds of music and to not have barriers.
Sure.
Because they suddenly introduced folk music to people.
They were folky, and then they were sort of metal, and then they were, you know, pop, and they ran the whole gamut. Yeah.
Yeah, and to my mind, not a lot of people have ever done it any better than them. It doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been fortunate to be involved with a songwriter, singer, performer, who's as talented as those guys.
Yeah, and just a huge career. Your music will live on, of course, forever and be appreciated for generations to come. It must be surreal for the Elton era to come to an end. What are you going to miss most about this band and this incredible career you've had? Have you thought
about it? I'll miss his jokes. I'll miss his sense of humor.
He's a funny guy.
He's hilarious.
Oh my God.
I mean, he's probably the funniest person I've ever met, apart from Billy Connolly, and he's so fast. Mm. So I will miss that.
Yeah.
Because we play a lot of word games together. I'm sure you do with Paul and
these
guys.
He's also very fast, and he needs stimulation.
Exactly.
Yeah, a lot of these guys do.
And we have great, great word games, which nobody in the room, they're looking around, what are you guys talking about? I mean, he came up to me one time and said, wasp, wasp, monarch. And I looked around him and said, oh, B.B. King. And right there started this whole new word game, you know, musicians with other things in their name. And that's how it started
It's just a bit of Cockney rhyming slang taken to another to another area.
So I'll miss that. I'll miss the whole friendship thing that happens within bands. But we've certainly played enough gigs. I don't know. There are certain gigs that we still play now where we go, that was an amazing gig. And that still blows me away that that can happen.
Sure.
Because we're not jaded in the least. Elton will never be jaded, thank God.
That's beautiful.
He's not that kind of performer. He always gets out there knowing he's going to kick somebody's ass. And I love that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, he's a fighter. Is there anything you'd like to say to those fans that have been in your corner for these five decades?
Oh my gosh, I'm so grateful to all the people that have come up and said so many nice things to me over the years about the role that, you know, guitars have been in the area of, you know, piano, basically a piano-driven band.
Yeah.
And because there have been some big guitar songs and some big guitar parts, and I'm very grateful to have been able to contribute those, but I'm also just grateful that people still love music enough to notice that stuff. Because that's the thing that guys like you and I notice that stuff. But sometimes you think, oh, nobody will notice that. Mm-hmm. Nobody will notice that little thing that I threw in there. But people do. And it's a wonderful thing that there are still music lovers out there who adore what we do. And shit, I'm grateful for that.
We're grateful too. I mean, what an amazing opportunity and honor to have sat where you've sat and stood where you've stood for all these years, to be witness to it and be a participant in it.
And you, man.
We're all aware of it, you know. We've all been watching you all these years. Oh, thank you.
I just watched you and Rusty up there doing one of the coolest gigs.
Yeah.
I mean that. I told you earlier, we had a blast watching that.
Oh,
the love that you guys have spread around comes back in buckets.
It really does. You see generations of people enjoying it. Yeah. We're going to wrap it up with a lightning round we like to call the encore. So it's said that tragedy plus time equals humor. Tell us, what is the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you on stage?
The most embarrassing thing by far, it happened very early on, actually, which could have destroyed my entire confidence forever. There's a track from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which has become very famous, called Funeral for a Friend. Love Lies Bleeding. It's a epic song to all the Elton fans and to many other rock and roll fans, mm-hmm. people who like classic rock. And what happens is there's a long, dreamy, you know, intro with guitar sounds and wind sounds and all this kind of creepy shit mm-hmm. going on. And from there, it goes into a beautiful theme with, again, very ethereal guitar sounds and wonderful sounds and a great piece. And everybody knows what's happening with the guitars and they love it. And people have come up and said over the years, love this thing. And then there's a big, long pause. And you were just waiting for this gargantuan guitar sound to come in. And I'm ready, just ready to come in. And the light comes on me. I go like that and nothing comes up. Nothing, not even a sound. And you got to remember, in those days, there was Elton and me, a bass player and a drummer. That was it. So it wasn't like anybody could go, oh, there's a mistake here or something.
Let me cover for you.
It was fucking obvious that I'm doing this, like the classic one of Pete's windmills, you know, and I'm doing that. Nothing comes out of it. And I look right at my roadie. And he was a roadie at this point. I'm going, fucking roadie. And I look around and he kind of goes, and I go, okay, this is your worst moment ever. And I was like a deer in the headlights. There was nothing I could do. So I basically turned around and went, tambourine. And he threw a tambourine and I caught it. And I just started playing tambourine for the rest of the song. And some people in the audience actually thought that that was supposed to happen that way. So I was able to bullshit it. But it totally killed me. And you know what? They never even mentioned it in the reviews the next day. So I kind of went, dodge the bullet. But somebody did mention it about 2 years ago. Some guy came up to me and said, you know, I saw that thing that happened at the Forum and I'm a guitar player and I saw it. That must have been terrible. I was like, oh God.
Here it comes again.
Yeah.
Well, we're happy to bring that back up for you again.
Thanks.
So is there one thing that you cannot live without on tour?
There used to be a lot of things I couldn't live without on tour, I thought.
Okay.
But I've given all those up.
I think I know what you're talking about. I might have some experience there.
You probably do.
Okay.
I've given up each one of those things.
Remarkable.
There's definitely one thing I could not live without on tour, and that is my guitar tech, Rick Salazar. He's been with me since 1986, and I stole him from Madonna. And he's a brilliant guitar tech. And in fact, I always say that he is 50% of what I do on stage and in the studio because he knows what I like. And you know that there's no substitute for that. To have somebody who knows the way you like to play guitar and the way you like it set up and et cetera, et cetera. You know, I don't even have to go anywhere near the stage when I arrive at a gig or a venue. I just have to, you know, do what I do, have some food at catering and then walk over and, you know, he plugs me in even. I don't even have to plug in. He plugs me in and I'm ready and I walk on stage and bang, we go.
Very good.
I trust him that much.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me and our listeners. It's been such a pleasure to have you. You've made a great impact on the world of music and we look forward to seeing what's coming next for you.
Thanks, Brian. You're more than welcome. Anytime.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you to my dear friend, Davy Johnstone, for those incredible stories and for his contribution to rock and roll that will outlive us all. On Tour is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by Mandy Wimmer and executive producer Noel Brown. And I'm your host, Brian Ray. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews and to interact with us, visit our social media at On Tour Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.